This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. In Kinston, one school that serves about 200 students is under review to close. Today we talk about the charter school, Children's Village Academy. Charter schools are tuition-free and are exempt from most rules and regulations applicable to public schools. They're funded like public schools with federal and state dollars as well as grants. The amount of money allocated to a charter school is based on the number of students. The Department of Public Instruction recommended earlier this month that the charter for Kinston's Children's Village Academy be revoked because of financial concerns. Children's Village Academy began operations in 1997 and was one of the very first charter schools to open in the state. Today, the charter serves students from a three-county area and preschool and kindergarten through eighth grade. Chairman of the Board of Directors, Mike Parker, says Children's Village Academy is located in East Kinston, the poorest section of the city.
I would say somewhere between 97 to 98% of our students qualify for free lunches.
The geographic location and student makeup of Children's Village Academy could be reasons why the school has struggled with cash flow problems and increasing debt.
This is not in a rich neighborhood, so nobody's reaching in their pocket and pulling out, you know, tens of thousands of dollars to help bail us out.
In 2010, Children's Village Academy had a negative fund balance of $80,339. 2 years later, the amount of debt increased by almost $100,000. It's the trend in mounting debt that concerns state education officials. According to the director of the North Carolina Office of Charter Schools, Joel Medley, Children's Village Academy was placed on financial disciplinary status in 2012.
That is the highest level of a financial warning that can be given to a charter school. Children's Village Academy had been placed on financial disciplinary status.
Medley says the number one reason charter schools are closed is because of financial concerns. In fact, 35 charters in North Carolina cited money problems as at least one reason for closing. The Division of School Business became concerned with the budget instability of Children's Village Academy when an auditor labeled the financial situation in 2011-2012 fiscal year as a going concern.
A going concern was due pretty much to the negative fund balance. It was due to the decline in their assets as well as some cash flow problems. And that going concern is a pretty big red flag that the auditor waves. Once we saw that information had been provided by their auditor, and we went back and examined and saw that they were in fact having an increasing number of students as well as an increasing financial deficit, we needed to move forward to initiate revocation.
Chairman of the Board of Directors with Children's Village Academy, Mike Parker, says a number of reasons have contributed to the charter school's financial woes, including increased energy cost, grant money drying up, and storm damage from Hurricane Irene in 2011.
Our school took a tremendous hit. We had somewhere in the neighborhood of $300,000 worth of damage. Some of our ceilings caved in. We had water in some of our buildings, and so we had to do extensive amounts of repair, and as well as, you know, replace things that were damaged, you know, things inside the buildings that were damaged.
Shortly after the hurricane, Parker says they discovered the building owner they're renting from didn't have enough insurance to cover the cost of repairs.
So we had to come up with, out of our local funding, we had to come up with enough money to get all the repairs done so our children could come back to school.
At the end of fiscal 2012, an audit report showed a deficit of $229,000. However, Parker says there was about a $50,000 mistake in that report, making the real deficit $179,000.
Same auditor came in and she did what's called a compilation letter. And she found out that we have reduced our deficit now from $179,000 to roughly, as of July 31st, we had brought it down to about $50,000. And we're projecting that by the end of the year, we're going to have most of our deficit taken care of.
Parker says they've been paying off their debt by generating money through fundraisers and budget cuts, but admits more stringent accounting practices are needed.
There's no hint, no indication at all that there's been any misuse of funds. It's more like, you know, we haven't done a good job of keeping within our budget.
Since, the school board has made a decision to turn over financial responsibility to an independent manager.
So we're working with Acadia North Star, which serves probably 70 charter schools in North Carolina, and they are now managing our money. And that has added another level of accountability And I think that's going to really help us solve our spending and deficit problems.
As a way to ensure financial stability in the future and fulfill a need for the community, Parker says the school plans to open a thrift store by next year. The State Board of Education was due to vote on whether or not to go through with revocation during their April meeting. The charter STEM Academy of Winston-Salem was also on the chopping block with Children's Village Academy, but their charter was revoked. The school board decided to collect more information on the Kinston School and voted to table any action until their next meeting.
I think that the real concerns that DPI had about our solvency are really over with. And I think that when the state board votes in May, they're not going to revoke our charter.
While Parker remains optimistic, Director of North Carolina Office of Charter Schools, Joel Medley, says a decision by the Department of Public Instruction could play out in a couple of different ways. Either the state board will dismiss the case, or they'll revoke Children's Village Academy's charter.
Then the State Board of Education would, in June, convene an appeal panel of the state board that would hear the department's side, would also hear the side from the charter school itself, and then they would ultimately make a recommendation to the full board. That could be to not revoke the charter. It could be to revoke the charter. It could be to come with some type of a settlement agreement in between. But this would just begin the initiation process. So their vote at the state board meeting in May will determine whether or not we continue down this path or whether or not we stop.
If the state board decides to revoke their charter in May, Children's Village Academy's Parker says they plan to appeal.
We would show up at the next state board meeting and present our case to them about why they should not take our charter away. But like I say, I really don't think that it's going to come down to that.
The Department of Public Instruction will meet May 1st and 2nd. Jared Brumbaugh, Public Radio East. On April 10th, Goldsboro High School received a prestigious award for its science program. Vernier, a technology and software company, along with the National Association of Science Teachers, gave out the awards to a handful of schools for innovative projects for students. The award includes the money to attend the conference where they'll be recognized, $1,000, and $3,000 worth of Vernier products. Next semester, science teacher with Goldsboro High School, Daryl Costin, whose science project idea won the award, will begin the experiment with a group of students. Stephen O'Connell spoke with Mr. Costin about the upcoming experiment.
It wasn't my original idea. I attended a workshop at North Carolina State University, and the idea came from that workshop.
Will you explain for me where you're going to be getting the samples of bacteria for the experiment?
I don't know exactly the strain right now because the paper's not in front of me, but we'll get a bacterial strain from North Carolina State, and we will use that bacterial strain to grow the cultures here at Goldsboro High School, and then expose those plates after the bacterial growth has grown to factors, environmental factors like UV radiation. Some will be exposed, some will not be exposed, some will have a sunblock, you know, to see whether or not if you sunblock will be equivalent to, you know, what people put on their skins, to see whether or not that affects the rate of bacterial growth.
You said you were a college student when you first did this experiment. What kind of problems did you face then that you'll have to teach your students now?
This was an idea that was given to me. I took it. I put the experiment together under the direction of my professor at NC State, and I performed the experiment over the summer. And, you're going to have your problems that are going to be in the setup, not necessarily in the collection of the data, not necessarily in the exposure via the experiment, but it's going to be in that pre-setup. Growing the cultures, making sure everything is sterile, making sure everything is clean as possible. We don't have nearly what we would need at NC State. I mean, the NC State has, you know, state-of-the-art equipment. We don't have that. So, but the main thing about this is to just get the students to do a real good experiment, something that they can go and produce and show to others.
I read that the research was using data collection as its main tool. Was the research just as much about the content of it as it was about teaching students to cope with data collection?
I think it's primarily a little bit of both. It's to get them the exposure with the probes and the technology, but as well as to get them the content and understanding the content and also the data analysis.
You got a grant from this software and technology company, Vernier. What technology will you be using to conduct the experiments?
We use a lab acquisition product from Vanir called LabQuest 2. And LabQuest 2 acquires the data, and then we also use Vanir probes to acquire the data with. And so we have different types of probes, like, for instance, a UV radiation probe. It detects the amount of UV radiation on that particular day. We also can use a probe that looks at dissolved oxygen as to whether or not that makes a difference in terms of the viability of the bacterial culture. And so you have all these different probes. You have a temperature probe. Then I also have a UV spectrophotometer that goes with this, and that's a separate entity altogether. So all these are separate probes that will generate separate data based on the experiment that you're doing.
And when will you start the experiment?
We will start a data collection probably maybe this summer, but more realistically probably in the fall.
So there's going to be a group of high school students starting this experiment soon. Who's able to participate in the project?
Hopefully I'm going to make it available, but surely is I'm only going to have about maybe 6 to 8 students from here and about 4 students from Dillard Middle School. Dillard Middle School is our feeder school.
This sounds like sophisticated research. How many hours do you think this will take up?
Well, once we get started, it's going to be, I would think, about maybe 10 hours a week. And it would probably run for at least a week. And then you would probably change the protocol a little bit and do something else with it.
And at what point will you step back and let the students figure out how to conduct the experiment?
Well, I'm gonna teach them sterile techniques and teach them the techniques of being able to culture the plates and to run the experiment as scientifically as possible. And then, you know, for them, it's their project, and I'll just be an overseer. But I think there's a lot of different things they can learn in terms of laboratory technology.
I'm speaking with Daryl Costin, teacher of chemistry, physical sciences, and earth sciences at Goldsboro High School. Thank you.
All right, well, I appreciate it, sir.
This is Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent, with this week's entry in the Garden Journal. Well, we're finally starting to have a little bit of warm weather, and I'm so excited. And you know who else is excited? All the insects. One insect that's starting to be apparent around the state are cicadas. Some of them are starting to crawl out of the soil. These cicadas will crawl up the tree and will molt and emerge as adults ready to fly. So watch around the base of trees for holes in the soil and watch on rough bark for the shells that these cicadas leave behind. When I was little, we used to take them and hang them on our shirts because they have nice sharp points on the ends of the shell legs that will hang on. You may think of cicadas as locusts, so start listening for their song and watching for them in the yard. If you're doing any repair work on a house or shed, you might find something interesting during cicada season. A little later in the summer, if you're using a circular saw outside, you may find yourself getting hit with adult cicadas who think you're issuing a mating song. My husband once had a number of them slap into his head and shirt as he was using his saw outside. So that's something to look forward to this summer. In addition to cicadas, you might actually see some outdoor termite swarms this week or next. Do recall that termite swarms outdoors are not necessarily a reason to worry. There's all sorts of wood decomposing in the soils around North Carolina, in the woods, on the edges of lots, and the outdoor swarms often are coming from these pieces of wood. Just think of them as a reminder that termites are natural and around us all the time. However, if you do see outdoor swarms, it might be a good chance to have your house checked to make sure you don't have active termites in the home. Now, if you have termites swarming inside your house, well, that's a sign that you do have a potential problem and you need to call someone immediately. However, you don't need treatment the same day. Take time, interview a couple pest companies, and determine which ones match your needs, and make a careful choice. So, watch this week for new insects of all kinds emerging. The most fun will be the cicadas. The most worrisome, possibly the termites. But in either case, they're just showing us that it really is spring. Enjoy looking for insects and other wonderful things outdoors this week, and I'll talk to you in next week's entry in the Garden Journal.
This is the Downey's Journal. In 1942, at the height of World War II, nearly 5,000 people were killed, many of them civilians, off the U.S. East Coast, as German U-boats waged a military campaign against Allied merchant vessels and military ships. Much of this occurred within the sight of North Carolina's coastal residents, and much of it was kept a secret at the time from the public. A Raleigh author looks at the 7-month-long period that brought a world war to the coast of North Carolina. George Olson has this, which originally aired in May 2012.
In the words of a U.S. Coast Guard chief petty officer who was in service in 1942, "I think the people on the Outer Banks saw more of the war in this country than anyone else."
The city of Atlanta was a freighter that was torpedoed 7 miles east of Avon Village, and it knocked knickknacks off the shelves of homes in Avon Village. And I also interviewed residents of Ocracoke who described the plaster on the walls of their houses being cracked by these violent explosions that would shake the houses or would crack the cisterns that they used to collect rainwater for their drinking water. And unfortunately, there were a number of occasions when bodies washed ashore and were found by residents of the islands of the coast.
Raleigh author Kevin Duff is concurring with the opinion of former Coast Guardsman Arnold Tolson of Mandio about a 7-month period in 1942 when German U-boats sought to disrupt maritime traffic and break American morale by torpedoing merchant and military vessels. Duffus recounts in his book, War Zone, World War II off the North Carolina coast, that for a period the U-boats operated with impunity. There was a 2-week period in March of 1942 where at least one vessel was sunk each day, but these sinkings largely remained unknown to the American public.
When the first U-boats arrived and they first began to torpedo merchant vessels, and civilian sailors began to be rescued, covered in oil and being brought ashore, the U.S. Navy was not prepared to put a lid on the news. In fact, the very first attacks off the North Carolina coast were covered in the papers within days. In fact, it was on January 19th that Reinhard Hartigan and U-123 torpedoed 3 ships off of Hatteras Island, just 7 miles offshore. And that news made it into papers like the Virginia Pilot and elsewhere. But if you go back and read the front pages of the major papers, which I did during this period, within 2 weeks, all of a sudden, they just completely cut off the news. There was no longer any daily reports about what was going on offshore. Now, the U-boat attacks had not stopped. In fact, they began to intensify, and more ships began to be torpedoed. But the media then was managed completely differently than it is today. And all of the major papers and broadcasters, primarily radio, agreed that this information really didn't need to be told because the government did not want to panic the American public, that the enemy was operating just 7 miles from our beaches.
Unknown or not, the war was taking place just off the U.S. East Coast with a heavy concentration of it off North Carolina, whose coastal waters Duffus describes as an area where ship traffic sort of merged, almost like an on-ramp for a major interstate, and the Germans knew it, partly from their own travels there during peacetime. And what those involved in the fight saw was horrific. Duffus tells the story of Mack Womack, who in 1942 was an 18-year-old Coast Guard recruit from Tennessee at his first wartime station on Ocracoke Island. Womack at the time thought he'd arrived at the last stop in civilization, but soon found himself on the war's front lines, trying to rescue the crew of the torpedoed British tanker Empire Gem struck near Cape Hatteras.
"We could see the orange glow in the sky a long time before we got to it," Womack told me, almost as if he could still see it in his mind, the burning Empire Gem on the horizon. At 0300 hours, Womack's motor lifeboat finally arrived on the hellish scene, the water ablaze with expanding pools of raging fires, clouds of choking, thick black smoke. and the ocean littered with the tossing flotsam of ship and human remains. The four men from Ocracoke Station couldn't maneuver their lifeboat near the massive hull of the stricken ship. Along the tanker's rail, high above, some British sailors, their clothing apparently on fire, could still be seen leaping from the deck to the burning sea below. High seas and scorching heat from the fires made the rescuers' gruesome task nearly impossible. The men from Silver Lake felt helpless. "All we could do is go around and around, hoping to pick up somebody that was alive," Womack said with a huge sigh, his eyes beginning to glisten. "And it's a terrible feeling, especially when you see them jump overboard with flames onto them and know that they was going into the fire just as quick as they hit. It had a really bad smell to it. It wasn't all oil burning."
Ships sailing under the flags of many nations came under assault off the U.S. East Coast, with those ships under U.S. flags occasionally containing North Carolinians, whose fate sometimes became known to their hometowns in fantastic and cruel ways. Such was the case of Jim Baum Gaskell, a native son of Ocracoke Island, who left the island during the Depression to find work as a merchant sailor on the New York-based freighter, the SS Carib Sea.
And the most peculiar thing about this story is that his father owned a hotel known as the Pamlico Inn, which was on the Sound side, not far from the Ocracoke Lighthouse. And his father walked out on the dock, which extended out into Pamlico Sound, and he saw this piece of flotsam, a board, washing up, and it was bumping into the pier belonging to the Pamlico Inn. And the father bent over, and Bill Gaskell was his name, and picked this board up and flipped it over, and it was the name board from the Carib Sea, his son's ship. He knew immediately. I mean, it's the name board of a merchant ship wouldn't wash into Pamlico Sound if something bad had not happened to that vessel. So they knew almost immediately that Jim Baum Gaskell's ship had been torpedoed.
There were many tragedies like that one. 397 ships were sunk or damaged by German U-boats in a seven-month period, while only a handful of U-boats were sunk by Allied forces. Victories were few and far between for those ships patrolling coastal waters looking for U-boats, but one morale boost came in the days after the sinking of the City of New York on March 29, 1942.
That evening off of Cape Hatteras, it was early spring, but the weather really was still winter weather offshore. And the wind increased to 20 to 25 knots. The waves were said to be 10 to 15 feet high. And by 10 o'clock that night, Mrs. Mohorovic began to go into labor. Some of the City of New York's crew members were manning the lifeboat that they were in, and they managed to pull a sail over the middle of the lifeboat where Mrs. Mohorovic laid back on a couple of water casks. And the doctor assisted in the delivery of this baby underneath a sail in pitch darkness. In 15-foot seas, he described it as trying to deliver a baby riding a roller coaster.
The destroyer, the USS Jesse Roper, found multiple lifeboats in the days following the City of New York sinking scattered across the Atlantic Ocean with survivors, including the lifeboat where Dusanka Mohorovic gave birth to her second child, a son, who she named Jesse Roper Mohorovic.
I had interviewed a crew member of the Roper who told me that their morale prior to this point was pretty poor. In fact, their sister ship had been torpedoed, the USS Jacob Jones, killing almost all of the sailors aboard off the coast of New Jersey 6 weeks earlier. So this made a big difference.
The naming of the baby after the destroyer was described by one of the USS Jesse Roper's crew as a real shot in the arm, and when the story of the baby born in a lifeboat hit the presses, the child became known as the baby Hitler couldn't get. The USS Jesse Roper brought the survivors into Norfolk and soon went back out to sea, where it spotted a German U-boat and sank it. Ultimately, what turned the tide for the Allies in the waters of the Atlantic wasn't U-boat sinkings, but workmanlike convoys of merchant vessels escorted by warships and air cover that limited the effectiveness of the U-boat's mission. By July 1942, with the recent sinking of two U-boats and two more damaged, the remaining boats were recalled to Germany. The U-boat sinkings caught the public attention. One celebrated sinking by a Navy pilot put him on a national tour with other war heroes, and he was photographed with major Hollywood stars of the day like Betty Grable. There was no such acclaim, however, for the men of the USS Jesse Roper, just another day at sea doing the work that ultimately ended the war off our coast. Kevin Duffus reads from War Zone, World War II off the North Carolina coast.
For the USS Jesse Roper, the job was not done. When the Navy tug Sciota left the side of the destroyer, The Roper unceremoniously hoisted its anchor and set a course for the waters off the North Carolina coast to resume its anti-submarine patrols. For the gallant and brave men of the Roper, there would be no ticker tape parades, no star-studded gala dinner dances at the Coconut Grove, nor, much to their disappointment, did they get to tell their story to Betty Grable. The last entry in the ship's log for that fateful day of April 14, 1942, when the Roper became the first American warship to sink a German U-boat in the United States waters, reads, "Steaming as before."
Kevin Duffus resides in Raleigh and is the author of War Zone, World War II off the North Carolina coast. I'm George Olson.
Kevin Duffus appears in Washington this Sunday afternoon to discuss his book War Zone and an event sponsored by the Friends of the Brown Library. The lecture takes place Sunday afternoon at 2 p.m. at the First United Methodist Church in Washington. Admission is free. There's more information at the events calendar at publicradioeast.org.